The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
And welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. We are here in North Canterbury, New Zealand at Pegasus Bay, one of the top wineries of the region. I'm here with the general manager, Paul Donaldson, drinking the 2016 Pinot Noir. Paul, first off, thank you so much for doing this. We came to drop by to try the wines, to chat with you. And now we're doing the podcast now, which is so much better in person than it would be if we did this in Zoom in a month from now.
I agree. I'm thrilled to do it.
Let's start here. When I think of your winery, beyond the portfolio and the Rieslings and the Pinots and so many beautiful aromatics and the sweet wines you do, I kind of think about family. I was wondering if you could explain to the listeners here just why this place is so much of a family affair.
Yeah, I guess we fell for the old classic thing where my father was a doctor, and all doctors seem to get obsessed with wine. And he started a little hobby vineyard in Christchurch, which eventually he wanted to move out to its own thing. And we kind of all thought, well, this is going nowhere. We lost all our sort of holidays and our weekends having to invest in his little business that we thought was going to be a bit of a red herring or a bit of a dud. And then it suddenly kind of moved on, and then it got bigger and bigger, and eventually we've all sort of realized we can't get a job in the real world, and we've been slowly sucked back in and are working here. It does mean that you're allowed to focus really on what you want to do, so you can focus on quality if that's your thing, because you're at the top of the pyramid, I guess, in terms of what you want to choose. So you can, we all loved really good wine, so we decided as a family that that's what we would focus on rather than anything else.
And was that big when you were growing up? I guess I'm assuming wine was always a part of the family and part of dinner.
Yes and no. I was quite a big beer drinker, and still am. Wine mostly revolved around possibly stealing and selling some of Dad's wine just to, have a good weekend.
Hold on, wait, I gotta ask. What was the best bottle you stole from your dad that you didn't realize how good it was, but your dad, said, Paul, I can't believe you opened blank?
Oh, look, I exclusively stole crappy wine.
Smart. Okay, but, so you did the right thing.
My brother Mike did, and I don't know their bottle, but he did open what he thought was not going to be noticed at a party because it was so old and so foreign looking. And it turned out to be like the most expensive bottle in Dad's cellar. So he was grounded for quite a while after that one. But yeah, I don't actually know the bottle, but I know the story.
Yeah, so no, but you would do the right thing. Newer bottle, if it's got the word Village on it, okay, you can steal it. If it's super old, then stay away from it.
This old Premier thing,
By the way, one thing I love is the idea that just about how difficult it is to make wine and have a winery and be a successful one, that it might actually take more hours and time than being a doctor.
Yeah, I know. Who would sign up for being a doctor 6 days a week and then put in wine? And it is a funny thing. Like, I look at it now and I think, how could anyone really get started in the wine industry? I think we worked out that it takes 7 years from, if you do it right, from choosing your site, grafting vines, putting them in the ground, getting a crop off them, and then having to actually see if anyone wants it. Like, the commitment is kind of unreal if you actually think, oh, I've got this big job, and then I'm going to just follow a probably 10-year path to maybe get a dollar back,
When we were talking before, because we were here earlier in the day doing this beautiful tasting, and I want to get into the whole portfolio of Pegasus Wines in a second, but you, in a past life, you dabbled as a banker, correct?
Yeah, not by choice, but by necessity.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you were a banker now and someone said, I want to start a winery, I need a loan, what advice would you tell them?
I'd say you're insane. You want to start with a really big fortune, you might end up with a small fortune.
It is crazy, just the economic model of it. It's the only business where when you get started, you have to be okay with, for minimum half a decade, even longer, you're not going to see a profit. You're not going to make a dime.
No, it's a passion project, really. And it's also it's not even about the money. The logistics are insane as well. Like, I have to shake my crystal ball and say, from 2026, I think I need this much Pinot in this style, but I'm only selling 2023, and who knows what the sales trends are going to do. So it's not even about the capital investment. The actual logistics make it, I would say, quite unappealing to banks, because the variability can blow anyone out of the water at short notice, I would have thought.
Let's go back to family for a second. How many people in the Donaldson family are a part of Pegasus Bay?
So six currently. It's been as high as 9 at one point, but we're at 6. That's me, my brother Ed, my brother Mike, my sister-in-law Belinda, and my parents Ivan and Chris.
That's cool. I mean, when you look at one of these bottles, immediately family must come to mind.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's an interesting thing. Like, it's the one product I find, or it's probably not the one product, but certainly from my experience, where people really love the family aspect because of the history in Europe and all those intergenerational winery estates. People just really enjoy the family aspect. It's quite a special thing in wine, I find.
Well, I think because there's just something personal about wine. I think it's one of the reasons we love it. At some point, we're going to hopefully get some of this wine home, or if not, we'll drink it in the hot tub that we're staying at a hotel nearby here. But eventually, at some point, we're going to find your wines at home. When I drink it, I'm going to think about you, and I'm going to think about your family. And I think for a lot of people, when they're at a restaurant and you have a good psalm, and they explain the story, it's like wine tastes better when you pair it with good food, but also when you pair it with a good story.
Yeah, absolutely. People, I find, you do tastings out there and they want to tell you about the time they visited your winery 15 years ago, because it's still a memory for them and it's still something that they look back to, and they then want to, and then my old thing that I tell people is, what I want to create is not really fans. I want to create acolytes that want to go out and on sell my product for me without me having to do anything, because they liked it so much that they are then recommending me to their friends and saying, you should try this wine, it's great. And the family thing definitely helps with that, but you've got to have good wine to begin with. So, yeah, I kind of and the thing is, I'm guilty of doing it myself. I try other people's wine, and then I say, you should try this wine. So, it's a powerful connection, I think, with wine.
Well, it's been acolyte for a second here. The 2000. Actually, let's start with you, because you guys are known a lot for Riesling. What Riesling are you sipping on? I'm drinking the 2016. I believe it is Pinot.
You are, yep.
But what Riesling do you have?
Oh, I've got the 2016 as well, because I opened these in our tasting, and then I had all my staff show up and they had such an array of other wines, they sort of ignored the older ones. And so here they are left over for us to enjoy, which I'm very pleased about.
And how would you, if you're going to tell someone about the 16 Riesling, how would you describe it?
Look, I think it's well aged without being over aged. We kind of do a 10-year release on these wines where we think they'll be drinking towards their peak, but not past their peak. It's got lots of fruit still, but some really great, we talked about this earlier, you shouldn't say petrol, but it's got some great petrol characters, because let's not pretend, that it's not petrol, because it smells like petrol. But it's also got the honey and the fruit characters, lots of tropical peaches. So, yeah.
And then what I got here, and I'm loving, the 2016 Pinot Noir. This is, if I'm going to be an acolyte, one mark of any great winery is, what does it taste like after a decade? And how is it just developing? And the fruit is all there, but the tertiary notes, the mushroom, the earthiness, like just the perfume. This is a beautiful wine. And for people that don't know about New Zealand wine and they just think Marlborough, Sauvignon Blanc, and that's fine. I get it. When you're starting out, that's probably what you're going to know, because there's more of that at the liquor stores, at the markets, than if there's anything else. But this is as well made a Pinot as you're going to find, I think, anywhere in the world. And it speaks to just how well this is drinking.
Yeah, and look, I think people thought we were a little bit insane when we intentionally started aging Pinot for 10 years and then releasing it in Rieslings. At that point in time, most people didn't think you could age New Zealand Pinot, let alone that you would strategically do it. We also had a ridiculous scenario where after 10 years we went to release it and my brother, who's in the sales and marketing, went, well, we can't really ask too much for it, or otherwise people will keep it for another 10 years and then it'll, then it might be past it. So we ended up only putting a $10 markup on it. So
it was
$1 a year I'm putting it in our warehouse. That's changed a little bit, but it's still not, we really want people to actually open this wine when they get it, rather than thinking it's something that they want to hold on to because they paid so much for it. So we've made them quite approachable on the basis that we want people to actually try them. We've done the aging, you do the drinking, you know.
How many places do that? I love the fact that, you know, it's not like there's some wineries that will sell some of their old wine, some of their library wine, but maybe they have a couple cases and it goes to people in the winery club, and maybe there's a couple bottles here or there. But, you know, you guys have, I think this one might be sold out, but I mean, you guys have plenty of it. It doesn't seem like a lot of wineries do that around here.
As far as I'm aware, we're the only winery I know of in New Zealand doing it. There's certainly, we do the same as other wineries as well, where we sell a little bit of cellar stock, but it's not intended, shall we say. We've been since 2006 doing this, and in fact we've enjoyed it so much we've added another wine to the range, the Bel Canto that you guys tried earlier. We've put in from the 24 vintage, we've put some down, so in 2034 that'll come out again. So we've got two Rieslings now and two Pinots that we're age releasing.
By the way, it's bizarre to think you're already going, okay, in 2034, you know. Yeah. Who knows what will be going on in the world then? I'll say the flinty notes, a little bit of like the burnt match, and not in a bad way, and just married still with a lot of dark fruit. Like, it's 10 years old, but the fruit is all over the place. You could put this away. You could put this away for another decade.
I mean, you could, yeah. But that's why you should buy two of them.
Yeah, exactly. I like how you did that. You mentioned earlier about how the one hard thing about having the winery business is you're already projecting ahead, and you use the word trends. What were the trends? What were the wine drinking trends in New Zealand when this early on at Pegasus Bay? I guess my question is, how much have things changed from back when you started working here versus today?
Yeah, well, I mean, back when I started working here wasn't quite when we started. I started working here in 2005. Yeah, we'd sort of moved from a country. We've had a national palate development. We moved from a country where everyone would show up to a barbecue with a box of beer, and now everyone started showing up with a bottle of wine. And then people started talking about Pinot being a thing, sort of moving away from those big reds that, you know, everyone drank in the 80s, but actually don't really pair well with our climate specifically. It's, you know, you kind of found yourself, you know, drinking by what your parents drank or what people told you, to finding your own palate and your own, I guess, choosing your own destiny, really. And now people are a lot more happy to try other things. That's led to a bit of a proliferation of slightly weird varieties getting planted that, as we talked about earlier, are a bit impossible to sell if you can't say them. And then we've kind of settled down to what New Zealand really does well, I think, which is sort of the big five: Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Pinot, Riesling, and Pinot Gris actually has got quite a big popularity now as well.
What makes this area so good? Let's go back to the Riesling for a second here, because you guys certainly have planted your flag on that varietal. What is it about this region that works so well with that grape?
We're the only place in the country, I think, that we get that real mandarin orange zest kind of character with hang time. So if you want to leave your Riesling out, this is a great place to do it, because you get an extra dimension. I've seen people do it in Marlborough, and I've seen people try it down south, and they get more concentration and more, you know, wines of greater depth, they don't seem to get that character, which I think is a real plus with Riesling. I think it works really well with the variety. Also, because of our kind of cold nights, we get great acid retention, and so the Rieslings age really well. Like, as an ageable proposition, we could open a 20-year-old Riesling, it'd be premium, I would say, you know, particularly now that we're under screw cap and not cork. So
I'm always nervous about the generalization question, but I always think it's important to ask, because when people are dipping their toe into New Zealand wines, they kind of want to know the difference. So between here and Central Otago, it's certainly a drive. But I'm wondering, what would you say are some of the major differences between the Pinots from here versus, say, the ones in Bannockburn?
Yeah, so we get, I think, during the growing season, they're kind of a hard and fast growing season. They bud burst later than us, and sometimes they pick about the same time. They get quite big heat summation. It seems to me that it leads to it's different by producer, but an overall slightly more red fruit driven style. Whereas we're a bit more dark fruits, sort of plummy, blackberry. And then we get a lot more savory tones as well, like the mushroomy, spicy thing is quite common even in young wines from our region. I think it's loosely based on our cold night scenario and our exposure to southerlies, so which generally skip Central Otago.
It needs to be said about the weather here, because we've had some hot days, but the moment that sun goes away, you're fleeing inside. It's not a dimmer switch, in terms of the temperature, it's a light switch. It goes from one temperature and then boom, it's so much colder.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And it's like I have people visit from out of town, and I grew up in Christchurch, so I understand. It'd be really hot. You go around to someone's house, you have to take a jacket with you, because even in the middle of summer, as soon as the sun disappears, the heat disappears. It's a very, our temperature system is quite driven by the sun. It's surprising. We actually, even now, because, you know, New Zealanders love to talk about the weather, we sit around, and if it's a rare night where it's still hot and it's dark, you're like, wow, this is unusual. We could stay out on the deck. This is crazy. Wow, how about this? You know, it's probably only happens like 3 times a year. So
it's crazy. We're from Canada. We have at least 3 months where at night it is still warm, where it can be 9 p.m. and you can be walking the streets. And here, yeah, it's funny just the difference. But I guess that also goes in the character of your wines here, as talked about earlier, just the diurnal shift.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a huge diurnal shift. And that's really because we're a long, skinny island in the middle of an ocean, as opposed to having a big continent behind us holding temperature and pushing it onto us. So, you know, Auckland and further north, Hawke's Bay, you know, they get hot nights because of just their latitude. But where we are, we're quite low down. And as when the sun goes, the heat goes. And, you know, it's great, actually. If you want to not have to acidify all your wines, you just get it naturally retained.
How old is Pegasus Bay? Like, for this region, where are you guys in terms of, as like, I don't want to say the OGs, but in terms of some of the older older vineyards in this area?
Yeah, so we're one of the oldest. In terms of vineyards, there was a couple, two or three here before us. In terms of wineries, we were the first custom-built winery in the area. So most the other producers that were here were sending their fruit off up to Marlborough, either for sale or to get made into wine up there and then right. sell back here. So when we built a winery, everyone was like, whoa, you're investing beyond a vineyard? That's crazy. We're certainly, there's one other operator still in business under their label that's the same time as we launched. So it's pretty OG, I guess.
And I bring that up because that was a hell of a risk for your dad. You know, it's one thing to go, oh, okay, I want to build, I'm going to make a winery. Let me just go to the more established areas where there's more proof of concept. And also, it's easier to sell wine from a region that everyone knows when you're here. And by the way, how do I pronounce it? Wairarapa? How do I pronounce it?
Waipara?
Waipara. You know what? Good enough. Anyway, Waipara. It's harder to sell wine from a region that people don't know. Same thing, it's easier to sell Chardonnay than it is Gewurztraminer. This whole place is... does represent a risk that your father took.
Yeah, no, it was a big risk. And look, going back to the name, we used to be called Pegasus Bay, and we had fine Waipara wine as our tagline. We changed to North Canterbury because we just thought it would be more recognisable. And in fact, in the New Zealand wine industry, you've got the Wairarapa, Waiheke Island, Waikato, Waitaki Valley. So there's a lot of Wais, because Wai is the te reo, which is Maori for water. So lots of places have a water reference in their naming because it was a stream they went past or a river. So to diversify, I guess, our marketability, we rebranded overall as North Canterbury. In terms of risk, I don't think my father saw it particularly as high risk. I think he just saw it as something to do with his one day off. And he had that fallback option. He could always be the head of neurology at Christchurch Hospital that he already was. So.
Okay, so yeah. So at the very least, he had a safety blanket going on.
He had a
on.
Safety net going on. Yeah. And I think he probably was just trying to keep us off the streets, you know, in terms of out there making trouble or forcing us to work in a vineyard. So. Yeah.
And your brother recently retired, but your brother, I believe, Matthew, was the winemaker here?
He was, yep, up until 2024. So that was something like 35 vintages, quite a lot of vintages anyway. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so the 2021 vintage we put down on paper is our 30th vintage, but we did the maths wrong. It was actually our 31st. So we called it our 30th vintage on site because the first vintage was actually made in my parents' garage in Christchurch, which was the first registered winery in the Christchurch city limits.
Cool.
Back in the day. Don't think our neighbours were that impressed with that. But, but yeah, so that would make... 34 would be the 24th vintage. So we're slowly creeping towards a 40th milestone in another couple of years.
What's the what are those older bottles? What do you remember them about how they tasted?
Look, it's hard now because we changed from cork to screw cap in 2002. So anything before then, I've had some crackers and I've had some absolute stinkers, and they've both been the same wine. The really early, so we when we did a tasting this morning, we tried our Sauvignon Semillon blend. The very earliest one was a Semillon Sauvignon because the Semillon came on stream earlier, and Semillon ages really well. So the last time I had that, that was actually quite drinkable, surprisingly, from 1992.
Really?
Yeah. But other than that, I don't have a lot of memories of them because I didn't join until after 2005 again, and I was hiding overseas and drinking, you know, 1 pound bottles of wine from the Superette and cheap beer.
So your palate has certainly improved since you came back here.
Yeah, I'm spoiled for choice now.
Yeah.
But there was a definite imposter syndrome 5 to 10 years where you sort of didn't want to say what you thought you were tasting because you assumed someone would say you were wrong. But I feel like I've moved to the point of acceptability now.
It is a funny thing in the wine world, and you probably get this when you're hosting events, is that people get sheepish. They don't want to say what they're tasting. They feel bad if they can't say 5 different descriptors about the aromatics and what's going on in the mid palate. It's a funny thing how wine is both incredibly enjoyable, but also can make people feel so nervous at the same time.
Oh, totally. Once you've spent a reasonable amount of money on a bottle, I think there's an intimidation factor that you know, if it's a $10 bottle of wine, well, you say what you think. But if it's a $50 bottle, you don't want to get it wrong. And in tastings, people say to me, oh, I'm getting a bit of nectarine. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
You're like, of course it's right. It's your mouth. Like, you know what nectarine tastes like. If it tastes like nectarine, like, your taste buds and my taste buds aren't the same. So it's not even, you can never be wrong. You can just, it's more common that you might all taste the same thing, but it's chemistry. It's how it works. It doesn't really, you can't get it wrong if it's your own mouth.
Unless if it's a single vineyard, 100% Cabernet Sauvignon, you're picking nectarines.
Yeah,
you may be a little wrong. Yeah, you know, and then
you can't get it wrong.
Yeah, and then you got to sort of smooth that out and try to lead them another way.
Yeah.
As someone who's, you know, you've done many different jobs and you've lived all over the place, does it amaze you the global impact of New Zealand wine? It's a tiny country. It's a small population. It takes forever to get here. It's in the corner of the earth. And yet, I can go to rural towns in Ontario and still find New Zealand wine. Does it amaze you just how your, you know, wines from your country are basically everywhere?
Absolutely. The last statistic I saw, and it was quite a while ago, I think, was that New Zealand overall produces between 2-4% of the world's wine supply. But yet most people that, it's all at a slightly higher end, so most people that have a wine knowledge know about New Zealand. So to get that level of representation for such a small production level is kind of, it's a little bit impressive. And New Zealand is terrible at sort of patting themselves on the back. They're all very understated and quite like, oh, you know, just, well, that's interesting. The reality is it has been quite a big success story. New Zealand's wine in terms of exports have moved up to, I think they're the fourth biggest export market for New Zealand by value, behind kind of dairy and, you know, meat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a small thing anymore. It's been quite a good international story, and it does help sell. New Zealand has quite a clean green image, and if you want to make really nice wines, you have to treat the land well. You're kind of in a position where you can't pull your vines up and move them to another block if something goes wrong. Like, you can move your cows to another block, you can't move your vines. So it is an environmental thing as well, and I think that's resonated quite well with the world.
Well, it's funny. It's almost like you guys are forced to be great farmers because you don't have a choice. Like, if you, in Canada, in Niagara, if there is an issue, you can go to upstate New York. You could go to Virginia. Like, you know, you could go to British Columbia. Like, there's so many places around if you need help. There's been incredibly horrible frosts in the Okanagan region, so they were able to source grapes from Oregon, from Washington State. But for you guys, you're kind of on your own, so it almost forces you to be good at your job.
Yeah, totally. Yep. And like I said, if you get it wrong, there's quite a big consequence. Like, it takes you 3 years to just plant a vine and get fruit off it to get to quality production. I mean, the French, what do they say? At 30 years, vines start really giving you good grapes. So it isn't a short-sighted game, but you've also got to know what you're doing all the way through, because there's no do-overs really in terms of time frames.
Love to hear a little bit more about the portfolio of the other whites. You mentioned the Rieslings, but if you were going to sum it up, and it's hard to do, but let's just start a little bit more of your white portfolio.
I mean, you name it, we probably make it. We've got all the kind of key varietals like Chardonnay and your Sauvignon Blanc based wines. We do a Gewürztraminer. We've got a Muscat, ridiculously. We've got Pinot Gris. Riesling we make under 5 different styles. So it's I think I did a count not that long ago, and for a winery our size, it seems like I think we make 36 different wines. So that's
a lot of work for that's a lot of work for your vineyard managers to do that many types of wines.
Yep, but I think that they really appreciate it. We do seem to be in a lucky position that everyone that works here views it as sort of a passion project, I guess, as well for them. It's sort of like everyone's family, and they're all pretty happy to go to that next step because the product is viewed very favorably. So yeah,
also, but it also speaks to just that this region, that it can handle it. There's certain parts of the world you couldn't do this many varietals this well.
Yeah, we are a bit of a chameleon. Like Central is well known for Pinot. They could do lots of Chardonnay, but they could sell Pinot, so that's what they do. The further north you go, it's a bit hot for some varieties. We seem to be in a sweet spot where with the right level of care you can do there's guys that do good Syrah here in North Canterbury. We do a Merlot Cabernet and a Merlot Malbec, and it's one of those annoying things. The marketers hate it. You can't say you're good at everything, but as a region, we're kind of good at everything.
Is there a country or region in the world that you were surprised was that you guys sold maybe more wine to than you expected?
Belgium. Yeah, we sell a strangely large amount of wine to Belgium, and it highlights to me, and I'm not saying anything negative about our other distributors, but when you get a really passionate distributor, it doesn't really matter what country you're in, they just love your product and they really do well. And they do well not just for us, but for quite a few New Zealand wines. They're a bit of a New Zealand specialist in Belgium, so it's kind of, I think that there's a wine market everywhere, and it's just about finding the right fit. And we're incredibly lucky that I don't think from memory we've ever had to approach a distributor in a country and say, would you sell our wines? We've always had them contact us and say, hey, we're already distributing, we'd love to support you and bring your wines in. So now we're in 34 different markets around the world, I think, currently. And as I say, we've never had to push into any market. That's just happened naturally, which has been lovely.
It's interesting. One thing I never thought about before is that obviously the quality of the wine is the number one thing in terms of popularity in a country, but I never thought about the importance of the distributor and the emotion and passion and just work ethic they put in to help push your product.
Yeah, almost every distributor is going to be working with multiple brands, and so you really want them to have experienced your wine. Quite often, if we get a chance, they'll come to the winery and we'll give them a really good tasting, and we'll get a chef in and cook them dinner and stuff. You kind of want them to experience everything that you have to offer so that they can, represent you in the best light when they're back home. It absolutely helps having them wanted to do it in the first place. So they haven't felt like we've shown up at a wine fair and said, hey, please, we'll give you a discount. Can you stock our wine? Mm-hmm. They've already made the choice before we did. So that makes it a little bit easier.
I wonder if there'll be a shift at all. And something I've talked about with a lot of the Ontario producers, because, I mean, our big thing is Pinot and Chardonnay. That also is, of course, the two biggest grapes in Burgundy. And we all know the costs of Burgundy. And I always wonder if New Zealand, how much will they benefit from the fact that your high-end wines aren't cheap? They're not Burgundy prices. And I wonder how much that has an impact on your sales, especially in Europe.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think, I can't even afford good Burgundy, really.
No.
It's like insane, the pricing. And it's more just a knowledge thing, I find. Once people actually realize what they can get for their money elsewhere, then that's really playing into New Zealand's hands. There's definitely a period of prestige buying where people, it's like, it's a shalibation. It's got to say champagne on the bottle, even though there's a million different good bubblies.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period there where I think people were just a bit obsessed with that had to say Burgundy, but I think that's definitely changed in the last 5 years. I actually think that the COVID thing forced people to look outside their usual places of purchase, and lots of stuff went online, lots of people found out they could get lots of other things, and it's, I think New Zealand's done quite well out of that.
Yeah, I think actually in Ontario, it's funny, it focused us to be a little bit more local. We're not as patriotic about our wines in Ontario as certainly it is here, as it is here in New Zealand. As we end this, first, if you're going to tell people that we're thinking of traveling to South Island and coming to this area, what are some things that people need to know if they wanted to come visit Pegasus Bay or just visit the surrounding region?
Oh, look, we're closed Tuesday, Wednesdays, but otherwise, come and get a great tasting in.
By the way, but that is critical. Anyone coming here, do your research about what is open and closed, because you guys are a lot more closed than we are in Ontario.
Yeah, but look, North Canterbury specifically in this wine region does a great food offering as well. So there's a lot of little artisan producers. There's little farmers markets. There's guys growing truffles. There's a place up the road from us if you want to get a good regional roundup, that they're called the Wiper Wine House, and they just do a general tasting of everyone that doesn't have a tasting room. So
yeah, they're not. By the way, they're not open today.
No, because it's Tuesday and Wednesday.
Monday. They're not open. Trust me. We drove by them today. They're not open today.
Yeah. Well, they will be at some point.
Yeah, at some point. That's what the internet's for. And then finally, what do people do? You know, again, the general overall ethos, philosophy of Pegasus Bay. It's a hard question to answer started by your father and almost like a relay race, and the baton's been handed over to other brothers and sisters. The general ethos of this place.
No sisters, sadly. All male line. I've got the only girl in my family in three generations.
Oh, it's all boys.
We're all boys my wife. But look, we pretty much decided, and we're stuck to it, that we would just make what we liked, and if other people didn't like it, too bad. Turns out that other people like it, so it's worked out quite well. But yeah, we pretty much decided that we would never release a wine that we weren't happy to drink ourselves, and that we would actually be happy to argue over a 1% difference in a wine to make sure that we got the very best, you know, that we were 100% happy before something went out there, to the point that, you know, we would hold back a wine for years until we thought it was drinking well to release it if there'd been some issue. Not that there really has been, but yeah, we are 100% quality focused, and we've decided that that's the most important thing. Once you deliver a subpar product and someone tries it, you've kind of lost that customer for life. So, you know, we know that people will look at the bottle, remember if it was bad. You just have to kind of work on them to remember that it was good all the time. And that's what we're after.
Paul, thank you so much for doing this. We had a great tasting earlier today. But also, it should be mentioned, this place is gorgeous. We're here on a gray day, but just the outdoor, you got that nice pond or lake and just all the outdoor space and the art, and there's a sign that says, please ask us if you want to feed the eels. First time I've ever seen a sign like that, but this is a gorgeous winery to visit.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's been 35 years of my mother really running the grounds. There's trees out there that I planted when I was a teenager. There's the eels that we've slowly trained up to be fed.
Actually, one last question. Can you tell the listeners about your label? About the first label that you designed. I almost forgot to ask this question. And if I forgot to ask, my traveling companions, Amy and Christy, would be yelling at me in the car ride the entire way afterwards.
Well, look, in New Zealand, it's called a bogan, which is like, yeah, you got the hillbilly haircut with the mullet at the back and early 90s.
What's that called? It's called a bogan hair?
Yeah, bogan in New Zealand.
Okay, we just got the mullet.
Yeah, yeah. So my parents said, look, we've come up with this name. It's Pegasus Bay. Could you design us a label? I'd shown some minor interest in art at high school, so they said, well, yeah, this is the guy. I had the Steve Miller Band Book of Dreams in my collection, and it had a Pegasus on it, so I pretty much just ripped that off and hand drew it. And then because I was a bogan and they're all into like burnouts and cars and stuff, I put flames around it, as you do. I gave it to my parents hand drawn on a bit of paper, and I thought they'll take that away to a designer and get it made to look good. Parents they knew how to save a penny, so they just pretty much copied it directly onto the label. And in fact, there's a wine store still in town, they're number one on our accounting system, who said to them, I will list this wine, but I'm going to turn the labels around and only have the back label facing out to the customers, because this is such a hideous label. And then after 2 years, my brother came back from wine school in Australia, and he looked and said, God, that's hideous. And he wasn't wrong. And he had it redesigned properly, which was what I would imagine. And look, here's another little Easter egg for you. You're probably familiar with the Sasakai label.
Mm-hmm.
That's a double infringement by us. That's the Steve Miliband horse on the Sassakaya blue label with the Sassakaya font. neither of them have sued us yet. Don't sue us, Sassakaya. And that, because we tried and we were like, well, we really like the Sassakaya label. So let's just put the horse on that and see what happens. I think we've probably gone past the level of being able to be pinged for trademark infringement. Yeah. 30 plus years, we should be okay.
Yeah. Well, I'll say the only thing I don't like about your wines, not enough flames on the label.
Yeah.
But beyond that, this has been a great day, a great tasting, so impressive. Paul, really appreciate it. Thanks so much for doing the pod.
No problem. Thank you for coming and visiting us.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I just mispronounced podcast. We'll just keep going. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.